are not necessary to man, nor useful to him except under certain conditions. But now we have found that even the poison of the rattlesnake has use if we know what to do with it. Thus all so-called useless things, says Paracelsus, are merely things the uses for which are unknown. There is nothing useless, because nothing can exist except it be sustained by life. Life sustains nothing useless. And the life in no thing can be considered useless or worthless. It has a purpose. And he evolved one of his great medical theories to the effect that there is a remedy in nature for every inharmony of the human flesh, and that the great tendency of man is to overlook the remedy because it is too obvious and too simple. If he would use his intuiting power rather than his analytical power, he might have solved his problems ages ago. He has forgotten that the mastery of science lies in the intuitive apperception of the principles behind science, not merely the continuous and repetitious experimentation on a single plane of approach. If then there is an energy for everything, and there is only one energy, basic, this energy is like the mysterious blood of the Messiah, the mysterious blood that was forever moving in the sangrail, the blood of life, the blood of the Son, the life upon which all things exist. Paracelsus therefore says all energy, in any and all of its forms, is essentially sacred. It is sacred because no human being can actually control it. The only way the individual can participate in it is by controlling himself, not the energy. Also, that there is no energy of any kind that is not a direct manifestation of the power of God. Thus, all things live upon deity and within deity, and all energy have therefore a divine reason for existence. And they are all manifestations of this one total energy, which is the root of all. Nutrition is actually the possibility of moving energy from one organism to another of compatible nature. This means that in some way a magnetic focus has to be established. Energy derived from food is not derived from the substance, but from the compound energy focus behind the food. Take, for example, a simple thing like a grain of wheat. To us, this is simply a seed. We call it the staff of life. But this grain of wheat, if understood in the Paracelsian manner, is also a universe. It is composed of an infinite number of smaller parts, coming very close to the electronic theory or the atomic theory. Each of these parts is different, and the arrangement which they form together and the sympathetic focus which is set up in them causes them to be wheat and locks within them the power of this wheat to come from an appearance of death to an appearance of life. so that a handful of wheat found clasped in the mummified hand of an Egyptian pharaoh and buried in his tomb for 4,000 years when planted in the ground grew. It could not grow, however, until the suitable situation was provided. This suitability Paracelsus greatly emphasized. All remedies operate only within fields of suitability. A remedy given at the wrong time or to the wrong person, though categorically correct, may fail. There must be suitability. And suitability means that there must be a capacity to receive the energy itself. Thus, when the wheat is made into bread and the bread is eaten, it is not the body of the wheat that nourishes. We now talk about the wheat germ and the oil from the wheat germ and how much more powerful these are than the chaff and the flesh of the wheat. If we go still further, Paracelsus said, these are all refinements. But the nutritional unit in the grain of wheat is totally invisible. It is totally incapable of being analyzed or examined. The only way we can ever know it is when we capture it in a medium. And perhaps up to the present moment, from a nutritional standpoint, one of the most powerful mediums we have captured wheat energy in is the oil. This will be consistent because in alchemy, oil is always the most important of all media. Oil is the alchemical substance which comes nearest to capturing life. Thus, the spiritual mystery of life in the sacraments of ancient times. These sacraments consisted of anointing the head with oil, and this was used to preserve the descent of the prophets, the descent of the kings, and the apostolic succession in the Christian church. The anointing of oil was the carrying of the Spirit. Thus, oil becomes a subtle medium, and many things are contained most subtly and sensitively in their oils, or in their elixirs, as Paracelsus called them, or in their essence, as the attar of roses, in which the greatest power of the energy of the rose is held. This is therefore adulterated many times in the making of perfumery. So the problem of nutrition was, according to Paracelsus, several fold. He was not, however, convinced that the separation of the energy unit from its formal structure was entirely suitable to man. He said, when you are feeding this mysterious sublimated substance, which has already passed through a great refinement or alchemical digestion, that certain energies are lost in this process. Therefore, if these energies are too subtle, there is no hay left for the horses. In your body, you have all these animals and plants. The plant requires good soil and fertilizer, which is supplied by one part of the grain. The animal requires another standard of nutrition, which is supplied by something else. And the inner life of man requires the essence, or the substance. in order to survive. It is therefore better to recognize that the body of the seed feeds the body, the soul of the seed feeds the soul, and the spirit of the seed feeds the energy spirit field of man. Thus ascension. All of these different levels of energy are normally released by digestion and distributed properly according to requirements. If we modify or change the elements before they are accepted into the body, some part of ourselves or our domesticated menagerie goes without. He would probably use this as one way of explaining the effect of adulterating food. That in process of adulteration, or in the process of various over-refinements of food products, there is danger to the system because of the destruction of the balance of the nutritional energy field of the food itself. Man as a living being lives upon life, not upon death. He lives not upon the flesh of animals, but upon an essence or an image. He lives not upon the poor, tired carcass of a carrot. He lives upon energy. And it is only to the degree that he is able to rescue energy that he is able to attain nutrition. These various food products also live by energy, which they derive from the earth and the air. Thus energy is like a great stream flowing forever in a circle, moving from one level to another and finally returning to the earth and the air to be redistributed, like the stream of a mighty river flowing from the mountain to the sea, to be gathered up by the rains and cast back upon the mountain. All of these cycles he regarded as the secret of man's health program. Recognizing now that man, at this stage of his growth and of his development, living in a world of energy which he does not understand, and still suffering largely from devitality, must seek for the ways to rescue his health and to restore his energy field. Energy derived from food sets up poles in the body, which in turn draw more energy, like magnets. If, for example, therefore, you take a certain food which contains a minute particle of gold, you take this food into your system, and the energy field behind gold is strengthened as a polarity in your body. The moment this polarity is strengthened, all gold in atmospheric state, all energy which reacts to the vibratory power of the gold polarity, finds in you a receiving station and flows in upon you. Therefore, the maintenance of the chemical elements within the body, although many of these elements exist only in very minute quantity, the maintenance and balance of these poles, this maintenance ensures man's rapport with the total energy field around him. The depletion of a mineral polarity in the body will result in man refusing or rejecting or failing to take to himself the energy from space around him relating to this pole. If, therefore, the pole of iron is weakened in himself, he will not accept iron from light, from the sun ray, from the air he breathes, or from pure cosmic space. the cosmic space motion of Paracelsus are probably the cosmic rays of today. But these rays, although they are constantly permeating, penetrating man, are not received or held by him unless their polarities are established in his own body. Some of these rays are of such nature that if their polarities are over-intensified and become too strong, can also destroy man. Under such conditions, nature protects him by giving him only the minimum amount that is necessary for his function. The study of this problem is now partly covered, but not totally. By the broad theory of biochemistry, but there is much yet that has to be done before this subject can be said to have been handled in a thoroughly Paracelsian manner. Thus, Paracelsus said, how are we going to get these rays and these catalyzing agents polarized in man who is suffering from some ailment and therefore is in trouble? This led to a further consideration. Why should man suffer from this imbalance? Why does not nature protect him against it? The answer, according to the Paracelsian corpus, involves three things. First, man does not inherit disease. He does not inherit cancer. What he inherits from his parents is psychochemical deficiency. If the parental body is deficient in certain chemical elements, it cannot supply these to the fetus. Thus, the individual inherits a lack. And because this lack, through its own depletion, is an absence of adequate energy of a certain type and kind, it opens the individual to such ailments as are natural to such depletion. If, therefore, there be in any family a tendency to ailment, noted for several generations, perhaps, where all members of the family at a certain age began to fear diabetes, cancer, tuberculosis, or any of these ailments, the child does not inherit them unless they are malignant at the time of birth and the child is exposed to a direct infection or contagion. Actually, what the child, therefore, must know, or what must be known for the child, is that immediately every possible effort from birth should be used to strengthen the depleted poles, increasing as far as possible the availability of the missing energy elements. If this can be strengthened, and it cannot actually be totally absent, because, as Paracelsus points out, the total absence of any one indispensable element makes birth impossible. The only thing that can happen is a stillbirth. There can be no essential factor totally missing. But there can be an unbalance in which some factors are not as abundant as they should be. Therefore, we will say that if the ailment involves a deficiency in copper, this does not mean that copper polarity is absent, but is not enough. Therefore, Paracelsus said, just as light and moisture must cause a seed to grow, So light and moisture must be brought to bear upon the seed of copper in the body of the person in which it is deficient, thus causing it to grow. And the soil necessary for its growth must be enriched so that it may draw adequate nutrition in its own substance and that its energy field may thereby be restored. And if it cannot be restored, then the supply must continuously be artificially provided to prevent the individual from ever manifesting the symptoms of the illness. This thinking for the 15th century is not bad thinking. And it tells us things that we should perhaps remember more than we do today. Now, Paracelsus has also been accused of being a magician, because many of the cures and achievements which he wrought were considered little less than miraculous. But it all breaks down to a pattern. He recognized a certain group of essential elements. He sought in every part of nature for such organisms as were abundant in these elements. And by means of these organisms, he sought to prepare the various remedies which he used. He carried his alchemistical researches even further than physical chemistry, because he said it is useless merely to depend upon the health of the body for the maintenance of the soul. Just as surely as the depletion of the physical elements represents imbalance in the body, so this depletion in some way bears witness to the depletion of the psychic and spiritual polarities behind. These must also be built, restored, and corrected. For a chemical deficiency producing a certain ailment in the body will produce a certain emotional tension. It will also cause the individual to think in a certain way. And as Samuel Johnson pointed out, a drop of green bile in the liver has been responsible for more wars than perhaps any other single cause. Wherever there is a physical disturbance, it bears witness symbolically to a psychic disturbance or a spiritual disturbance of some kind in these energy fields. As a magician, Paracelsus attempted to take pure substances carefully prepared, and apply them where the deficiencies existed. He did not depend totally upon, for instance, physical gold. He knew that gold had an affinity to the heart. He knew that the magnetic field of gold carried a powerful heart stimulant and regulator. But this was not enough. Even if the physical heart of man could be brought back to reasonable normalcy, there were other things to be considered, namely the psychic field behind it. Or, in most instances, these depletions run through an entire chain of vehicles or through an entire group of processes. So Paracelsus said, the next thing we must do is strengthen the gold. We must make the gold more versatile. Because actually, gold has a meaning to birds and plants. It has a meaning to the magnetic field of the earth. Pure gold brought in contact with various things may have various reactions. It may cause one thing to happen in a plant, and it may be quite different in its effect upon a dandelion and a rose bush. Therefore, it is not enough that we deal with gold. If that was the answer, all we would have to do is associate ourselves with the seven sacred metals and we would all be well. But like the mysterious ring of Gyges, this is not enough. The next problem, therefore, was to recognize that kind of gold which was essential to man, dividing this gold from the gold of nature. The next problem after that was to compound gold in itself. And to do this, it was necessary to capture within gold a group of magnetic formulas. Paracelsus did this by invoking the aid of planets. He used various planetary configurations at the time of melting and casting gold, declaring that under various seasons, at various altitudes, and in various localities, gold, while in a mutable state, took upon itself specialized attributes that were not always present. Having prepared these formulas, Paracelsus then went a step further into what is commonly called today transcendental magic. He pointed out the Egyptian belief that every symmetrical solid, that is, the geometrical forms which form symmetrical bodies, that each one of them had a therapeutic power. This therapy being the capturing of energy in line, that form and the design of form captured and held energy. Therefore, that a picture of an energy carried a certain reaction of that energy with it. Some years ago, I made a number of experiments with the Paracelsian concept of primary form using sensitive electrical equipment to determine the radioactive result of energy form. We observed that a person looking at a cube measured a certain degree of energy. That when this same person looked at a sphere, the energy rate changed. This is the Pythagorean formula, that if the correct form can be produced or presented in nature, that the individual can be healed through the eyes. That order, mathematical sequence, proportion, design, color, arrangement and sound all can be equally therapeutic. The great art is to distinguish clearly which of these tones exaggerates and which minimizes the activity of energy fields on various levels. Paracelsus then took his soul, which he had carefully mutated. He then inscribed upon it a certain form, perhaps one of the symmetrical solids. He then also captured upon it a group of sounds through words, much as the mantrams of the East or the sacred syllables upon the petals of the Buddhist lotus. He held that not only were these figures, letters, designs, and sacred tracings important because of their sound equivalent, but because the individual seeing letters thought words in his own mind. When he saw a certain word spelled out, he did not have to speak it. In his own mind, that word took living quality and was interpreted as an idea. Combining all of these elements together, Paracelsus fashioned talismans, sacred to all of the planetary and celestial bodies, ornamented with certain designs, and inscribed with certain sacred thoughts, prayers, magical invocations, or the names of planetary or zodiacal angels, following the ancient magical concept that had come again from the Gnosis and from the Syrian mystery. And having gained all that he could, and in this knowledge he was greatly aided by the Arabs, who had carried it much further than the Europeans. He then placed this carefully prepared talisman or medallion upon the body of the sufferer in the area where the disturbance was, or where the pole of that disturbance could reasonably be assumed to be, either over a nerve terminal or close as possible to some vital organ. He bound it there or held it there in various ways, declaring that this medallion, this talisman, this thing which was not different from a sacred relic of religion, essentially, having been duly and properly prepared according to an exact knowledge of universal procedure, that this became a catalyzing agent, becoming powerfully radiant and capable of bestowing supporting energy to the part of the body involved. He left several manuscript works dictated to his disciples relating to this phase of his energy study. But we cannot follow him too far at this point, because it is only a fraction of the tremendous amount of reflection that he bestowed. His second concept was equally interesting, namely that almost all of the talismanic devices, including the geometrical forms, the harmonic chords, and the musical modes which were used in ancient times in religion and therapy, but nearly all of these had a certain and powerful success because of their reaction upon the human mind. Therefore, he came to the conclusion early that one of your most powerful gathering powers and distributing media is the mind itself. But the physician, knowing how to direct his own mental energy, can, through conformity with the laws of structure, stimulate or vitalize magnetic fields. He must, however, understand thoroughly how to condition this energy, how to bring it into that kind of energy necessary to assist the patient with a particular ailment. Paracelsus did not believe in simply the good thought method. He believed in the scientific directing of a conscious formula, just exactly as specifically considered as a pharmaceutical formula. But just as the doctor gave a written prescription to be filled, that the physician with his mind devised the prescription and then directed it by mental energy to the patient, that the patient could and would respond, finding temporary assistance over a crisis or a critical situation. In this same development of energy, Paracelsus pointed out that there were two very important factors that had to do with energy. One of these factors was faith. He acknowledged primarily and immediately that much healing was faith healing. But he said, do not for one moment suppose that faith healing is not scientific. It is not scientific usually for those participating in it. But if it was not a scientific fact in nature, it wouldn't work. In other words, it is a science that man has not discovered as a science. The miracle being the scientific fact unknown. Faith healing operates according to a distinct pattern of laws. The most important of these laws is that by means of faith, the individual becomes receptive. Faith, belief, these are equalizing and tranquilizing powers. Therefore, a little faith is as good as a sleeping tablet. A little faith is better than a tranquilizing drug. The purpose of the drug is simply to break tension. And the most simple and natural way that man, in his intuitive idealism, has discovered to achieve this end is through the simple fact of faith. Under faith, he ceases to fight. Under faith, he becomes patient. Under faith, he has a natural believing. And under faith, also, he places himself psychologically in the care of something other than himself, which is his most important contribution. The moment he stops taking care of himself, he gets well. The reason being that he does not know how to take care of himself and hasn't the willpower to unfold a program and keep it. If, however, through faith, he ceases disobeying, if through faith he no longer blocks the psychic field through tension and pressure, he becomes open and available to remedy of all kinds. Paracelsus said, when you take a medicine, the first duty of the medication, or the first need of the medication, is that it shall overcome the disposition of the patient. Man takes the pills and don't believe a word of it, but I'll take it anyway. You have to get over the disposition of the patient. Or you have to get past the indiscretions which his disposition are causing and thereby interfering with his health. So between the medication and the ailment is always the disposition of the patient. If through faith this disposition can be brought into a certain natural sanctity, a gentle and devout attitude, the medication, whatever it may be, can be more effective. And also, the resistance of the body to the active principles of the magnetic field will be reduced. As most ailments begin primarily in tension, anything that will help to remove tension is therapeutic. Paracelsus also tells us the importance of prayer. He tells us, scientifically speaking, that prayer produces very much the same results as faith, except that faith is a receptive believing, whereas prayer is a more positive or objective statement of conviction. Prayer is associated with a positive internal intuitional visualization of principles. The individual in praying, either audibly or to himself, fashions actual words states them and solves them with a conviction, and in that way performs a simple, intimate, personal religious action. It is obvious that the human mind is so constituted that it cannot hold several ideas simultaneously with the same intensity. The prayerful attitude, the prayer formula, the visualization in word and symbol of a strong belief, these set up vibrations which adjust to and associate with the magnetic field. Therefore, a positive statement of prayer has a vibratory positive rate, which rate is therapeutic because it carries with it devotion, a subconscious sense of sublimity, a restoration, at least temporarily, of a certain spiritual relationship between man and space. These factors set up motion. They set up reaction in the magnetic field. So by our thoughts, by our words, by our deeds, as Zarathustra tells us, we achieve virtue. And virtue now for the body is a state of health. If then, through indiscretion, energy fields have been depleted, we can do one of several things. We can either do as the animal does by instinct. We may simply relax back into adjustment. And if we can succeed in doing this, we will probably find almost immediate assistance. It was intended primarily and eternally, as Paracelsus clearly states, that each human being is to be his own physician. The existence of the physician is a proof that man has not yet come into his own full birthright. Man becomes a physician for himself by keeping the law and by holding such attitudes as preserve the integrity of the magnetic field. The moment cross vibrations come in, we have a depletion of energy. Negative vibrations move in one direction and positive in the opposite. These clashing neutralize or destroy each other's effectiveness temporarily, and the structure is damaged. Actually, no vibration of a negative nature can injure a positive vibration, because your positive vibration is true and can never be anything else. But the negative vibration set up in the compound constitution of man cuts him off from the positive vibration, thus leaves him incapable of responding to it, and therefore in a sickened or depleted state. This problem of sympathy, Paracelsus then carries through the various fields of therapy with which he is primarily concerned. He points out that the complete circulation of the body, due to proper clothing, proper exercise, proper light, proper work, proper rest, proper sanitation and cleanliness, these things are regulated, helping the individual to prolong the usefulness of his material energies as far and to as great an extent as is reasonably possible. Therefore, to neglect or ignore these is the simplest and most common way of injuring oneself. The next is through false nutrition, the introduction into the body of material, the psychic poles of which draw energy of the wrong kind. Anything, therefore, that man sets up artificially as a polarity, and which represents something not suitable to his true nature, or, if suitable in very small quantities, is not suitable in larger quantities, if such false polarities are established, then the individual may rapidly come under pressure from the energy field, which may be habit-forming or may result in the destruction of his natural human integration. The next point of great danger, of course, is that whenever tension, pressure, or stress have a tendency to reduce function, they attack first of all the great abdominal area of the body. The individual usually, and except in comparatively rare cases, always dies first in the abdominal area. This means that it is through the disruption of the processes of assimilation and excretion that the backload of toxin is built up in the body. The abdominal aorta and the great abdominal plexi and ganglia are the ones that react almost immediately to tension and lock the entire process of assimilation and excretion. When this happens and the condition is not corrected, the body is poisoned. And this means that gradually the energy fields are broken away from the body. These links between energy and matter are so polluted that the energy is no longer responsive to these polarities. The vibratory rates are lowered, and the body, gathering lower energy levels from its own lower rate of vibration, reduces its own function until finally it is no longer able to maintain itself. Thus, the problem of breaking tension and preventing obstruction. Wherever obstruction reaches too advanced a state, there is a corresponding local beginning of the process of death. This process of death is a localized disintegration. If this is permitted to go on, like the death of a finger and gangrene setting in, the whole body may ultimately be destroyed. Therefore, obstruction, anything which prevents the adequate flow of energy, must be watched with the greatest of care. This energy flow through the body is not by means of the physical nervous system, but by means of a vital etheric counterpart, which is called the vital vehicle. This vital counterpart carries within it the very tiny streams of energy. And where your arm goes to sleep, or something of that nature, through pressure, or through being placed in an unnatural position, this simply means that the etheric magnetic field has separated from the physical structure, and therefore that the physical structure is temporarily without energy nutrition of a certain kind. All, of course, is not covered, because all energy does not move in the etheric field. But it is cut off temporarily, and the return of this energy field, which must break through the skin now to return to its present or normal situation, causes the prickling that accompanies the awaking of a sleeping arm or leg. Paracelsus observed that in the case of the amputation of a limb, that the etheric part of the limb remaining with the person retained indefinitely a sympathy to the dismembered part. And he brings in a number of instances in which pain has been reported in an amputated arm or leg. Examination proved that when the arm or leg which had been cut off was buried somewhere, it had been put in a wooden box with the lid nailed on, and one of the nails had gone into the member. When the nail was removed from the amputated member, the pain in the living person's invisible arm stopped. Among interesting examples of that, unless we regard it as totally superstitious, is that exactly the same report is given to us by Lord Horatio Nelson, who said that he continued to feel pain in his own amputated arm for years. And on many occasions, when in the dark, had the complete feeling that he had the member. Thus, Paracelsus said, these magnetic fields have sympathy to each other. The difference between the etheric vehicle and the physical body is also of another kind, namely, that it does not mend itself from any scar or anything of that nature. The physical body will mend, but the etheric counterpart will retain the scar forever. And all scars on the body are due to the scars in the etheric field. If, however, the scar is removed by plastic surgery, it is not removed from the etheric equivalent. And those possessing any extrasensory perception can continue to see the scar after it is no longer visible. Paracelsus also pointed out that sharp instruments can injure the etheric part, even though they do not touch the physical body at all. And this gave rise to the idea of Digby's weapon saw, that an instrument which has pierced the etheric field of a human being like a sword and wounded him, that this sword will carry from that time on something of magnetic sympathy with the person it struck. The steel will take on the magnetic pole. Thus metals and substances become exchange polarities for vital and energy sympathies. And from this great concept of these related sympathies and how they could be adjusted to serve man, and how the human being could develop an entirely new concept of therapy by the association of his own body with other substances, would be the continuance of our discussion of this sympathetic theory, which now enters into the field of the mnemia, or the mysterious substances derived from the dead, which are used to maintain the life of the living. And for these phases and the next step of this subject, as I told you, we'll have to wait until next week.